Welcome back.
It's really hard when it gets together.
We don't have a computer, but I don't think, but we're going to start. We just. So if Ms. Manning from the Department, Director of Health Promotion, Department of Health would come down and get ready to testify. We have four reports today. The first three, I think, are straightforward. There will be time for questions on those after the presenter presents. And we think the most interesting one in terms of controversy is the last one. That probably means I'm wrong, and the first one's really controversial. So anyway, welcome to the committee, and your report's in our folder right there. Is that right? This is the Alzheimer report progress update thing.
Good afternoon. My name is...
Okay, welcome. Yeah, go ahead.
Chair? Sorry, committee. My name is Mary Manning. I'm the Director of Health Promotion and Chronic Disease with the State Health Department. Thank you for the opportunity to update you on the progress that's being made on the legislation passed to address Alzheimer's in Minnesota. One of the first components of the legislation requires us, or the commissioner, to make recommendations for future measurements aimed at improving our assessments and our care related to Alzheimer's disease. We at the department are contracting with Minnesota Community Measurement and working with Preparing Minnesota for Alzheimer's 2020 to craft that measurement. Currently, the different quality measures are being vetted. Minnesota Community Measurement believes that that work will be done about the beginning of April, and that should meet our needs because it will feed into the other two components. The second activity in the legislation is the creation of a learning collaborative. Staff, again, have been meeting, working with Preparing Minnesota for Alzheimer's 2020. There's a work group that's establishing the format for care coordination for Alzheimer's patients. The work groups are trying to come to consensus on best practices for early screening, the education of to providers and families on the importance of early identification, and management of Alzheimer's. All these components need to be completed before we can do a really good job on developing the collaborative learning collaborative curriculum.
Ms. May, let me call a meeting to order. We have a quorum now, so now you can actually talk to an official meeting. So we're in order. Welcome to the committee again.
Thank you. Fortunately, we have many experts that are interested in developing this learning collaborative, and we will be starting that work in earnest in March. A third piece of the legislation requires the Department of Health and DHS and the Board on Aging and our partners to look at current Alzheimer's literature. We're looking and documenting the current outcomes and cost of the current practices for caring for Alzheimer's patients. What we will be doing and what we have started to do is to compare the current practice outcomes and costs to those that have been done where studies or practices have been implemented where there has been an earlier identification of Alzheimer's patients. And there has been a much improved, a really quality involvement of caregivers, and where there has been a good collaboration between medical care management and community supports. So as we get more information on those types of studies or places where that type of condition exists, we'll be comparing that to the current practice of care or the practice for the past couple of years. That is the extent of my presentation. Questions?
Okay. Yeah, thanks. Representative Gottwald has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And not so much a question as a thank you to the department and also to the Alzheimer's Association. I sit on the Alzheimer's 2020 Steering Committee with a number of really wonderful people who are trying to get us ready for this tsunami of Alzheimer's and dementia cases we're seeing coming at Minnesota. Cost implications alone are in the billions and billions of dollars. So this is very important work. We realize this is a kind of a beginning step that we put in place a year ago, and appreciate all the good work that's been done so far, but we have a lot of work to do to get Minnesota ready for the wave of Alzheimer's and dementia cases we're going to be seeing in the next several years.
Other questions or comments? Anybody? You can escape while the getting is good sometimes. Thanks for coming. I really appreciate you coming down. And if people have questions, they can follow up. Now, if the next one on nursing home regulation relief, and while they're coming, Representative McElpatrick was intrigued by the minutes, I think, and would like to, yeah, some of the best minutes we've had, I think, the entire session, I think. Anyway, we're all here, it looks like, so she'll move the minutes. Any questions or discussion about that? Seeing none, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thanks for the help. Welcome to the committee. Now we're going to hear about nursing homes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, my name is Darcy Miner, and I'm the Director of Compliance Monitoring at the Minnesota Department of Health. The Compliance Monitoring Division regulates a variety of health providers, both individuals and facilities, and today I'm focused on nursing homes, which we regulate under both state statutes and rules and also federal law and regulations. A little bit of brief background. In order to participate in the Medicare and or Medicaid program, a facility must be certified, which means that they are in substantial compliance with the federal regulations. Staff from the Department of Health make on-site inspections or surveys of all certified care centers approximately once per year. The result of that survey is provided in writing to the facility within 15 working days of our exit. Currently, that document is given to them in hard copy, and if there were deficiencies cited, then they must provide us with a written plan of correction advising how they will address each of the deficient practices that we cited in order to get back into substantial compliance. Deficiencies are assigned a scope and severity using definitions from CMS. In broad terms, the scope ranges from isolated, which is generally it affects one resident. There's a pattern, which would be perhaps 2 to 5 residents, or widespread, which is generally something that affects either all the residents or all the residents of a wing or a floor. The severity ranges from no actual harm with potential for minimal harm all the way up to immediate jeopardy to resident health and safety. A written plan of correction is currently required for all deficiencies that we issue. So the first waiver that we were directed by the legislation to request from CMS was to eliminate the requirement for written plans of correction for federal deficiencies issued at a scope and severity that was not widespread, that did not cause harm or immediate jeopardy. The second waiver that we requested was to issue the federal survey to the facilities electronically. We had a conference call with staff from the Region 5 office in Chicago of CMS on January 31st. At that time, they advised us that they did not have the authority to waive the requirement for a written plan of correction. They did, however, give us authority to pursue a system to issue the federal survey form electronically. They've indicated that they will send us a letter to confirm those decisions, but before they would, they were going to consult with staff in the Baltimore office of CMS, their central office, and make sure that central office would back those decisions. In the meantime, I would anticipate that we'll begin conversations with staff in Pennsylvania and Indiana, which are the two other states which are currently issuing the survey reports electronically. Mr. Chairman, when I do get a written report from CMS, I'd be happy to forward that to sort of complete the request that we were sent to seek those waivers from CMS.
Maybe you can help me out here. We're trying to help keep our nursing homes open, focusing on real big problems. And it's just amazing to me that Baltimore has to decide if we can have electronic reports or not, and only two states do them, when everything else is electronic. Senate doesn't even have paper amendments anymore. They just have, I wonder if they asked Washington if they could do that. And, you know, I'm frustrated. We've been trying to give some relief in a meaningful way, regulatory-wise. Did we ask the wrong question about this E and lower thing? Because some of these deficiencies are just lame, meaningless, trivial items. They don't require much of a correction thing because it's just something that they had to find, and I'm frustrated. And I know the pressure's on you from CMS. If you don't find enough stuff, then they're going to yell at you for not finding enough things, which it's just madness to me, and it doesn't take into consideration the welfare of the patients and the clients, and it makes it impossible to run a business. and because they're worrying about the minutia and ignoring some pretty significant things they'd rather spend time doing. So that's my editorial. And so do you have any advice for us? I mean, we spent some time chatting about this, and you do they just is there something we could ask them that they would say yes to that would give some relief to our well-intended, good-behaving nursing home?
Mr. Chairman, I had actually hoped for a different answer from them, because at meetings that we've been to in Chicago, we've raised this issue before. We've been pushing to not have written plans of correction at all. And in fact, on the phone call, I said, well, if you don't like me picking and choosing, I'd be glad to not issue or, you know, to not require plans from anyone. And they said, no, they couldn't do that because they weren't ready to do it across the country. And I countered that, hence the waiver request. I wasn't asking for it for the whole country. I was asking it for us. Most of our deficiencies that we issue are D's or E's, which would qualify for what we asked for, which was no written plans of correction required. I'm not sure that there's a different way or a better way or something different we could ask for that would get at what we want. The other waiver request asked not only that we would be able to issue the reports electronically to the facilities, but that they would be able to send us an electronic plan of correction. It's a very minor step, but I think it is something that the facilities have been wanting to do as well.
Well, I'm not going to that kind of business. I'm just you have to have the patience of Job and then beyond. Questions from members? So we're trying here, and to the audience and the people who tune in for this segment, if you're running a nursing home or the look-alike, see if you can think of something, another way to ask the same question or a different question. But the money is not going to get any better, and especially from Washington. They can't agree how to extend the little payroll tax cut on stuff they decided they could agree to back in November, you know. On either party, this is a bipartisan, not getting along out there, and we still have to do our business out here. So, and you're just the messenger. I hope you sense I'm just going past you to CMS and to the whole system. But members in the committee and to the audience and advocates and whoever, we've got to find a way to help our good places stay in business and not burden them with unnecessary regulation, letting no one be unsafe at the same time, and make sure we have the right rules. So. There's a fair amount of time yet in this session, and I'm open to any good ideas, and the department, I think, is trying to do what they can with their hands tied by some ridiculous regulations from people who seem to like them. So, what do you really think? Anyway, thank you. Anybody else want to say anything, or does that sum it up? Representative Huntley, you want to pile on, or are you okay?
I agree with everything you said. I'm congratulating you for that.
And, you know, just Ms. Manning, and we have a new director who seemed very interested in Minnesota. We met him together. I think there was a meeting. He came out and of CMS, the Chicago fellow. I don't recall his name now, but he just seemed like a really sensible person. And maybe we can work with our person and just help them to see where he thinks we can go. He knows Minnesota is a good state. He knows we care across the board about our people. We want safety and quality. So maybe if we can try to hook up something with that, between Christine and your department, and we can try to find a way to get a dialogue going that would be productive. Anyway, so you're trying to escape. I don't blame you. I think you're dismissed, so run while you can.
Thank you.
Mr. Held is going to come down and give us a spellbinding report about the nursing project facility pilot project update. Mr. Held, can I blame you for CMS?
Mr. Chair, blame me for whatever you want.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Bob Held from the Department of Human Services, and I'm here to give you an update on the development of a report to the legislature that we're doing on conducting a nursing home / assisted living pilot project. The assignment and the purpose of it came out of the 2011 session, and it wanted us to look at a population of people who are in nursing homes but who providers feel don't definitely need to be in a nursing home, that they could be in assisted living, but there's reasons why they can't be, such as that assisted living doesn't pay enough for a person of that type, a person with their characteristics. So we were asked to recommend to the legislature on how to do a pilot of this new form of service, possibly a new form of licensure. And we began working on that in late July. And to give you just a sense of the methodology that we undertook for this, we formed a leadership group because this required us to work with a couple divisions at DHS and with the Department of Health. So we got about five or six people together who were going to be responsible for working on this project. We developed a work plan. How are we going to go about doing this? We then wanted to meet with the author of the legislation to share the work plan and get a sense of comfort that what we were, the way we were going to approach this kind of met with that person's expectations. And we did have that meeting, and it did. We then wanted to, well, we felt we had two ways we could go. We could either just write a report, or we could look for some key informant, some stakeholder type of input. We chose the key informant input, and we scheduled meetings in three locations across the state. We started out in Waseca, then we went up to Alexandria, and then we returned to New Hope, where we had our third meeting. And that all took place around the middle part of January. After the meetings, we then began to work on writing the report. And I think that the people that were involved in that, including myself, were really grateful that we had chosen to take that approach, because it really gave us a lot of new material to think about in writing the report and how to approach this whole assignment. There were a number of themes that emerged in the course of having these stakeholder meetings. Probably the most prevalent one had to do with funding. A number of messages related to funding, such as you should pay more for nursing homes and you should pay more for assisted living. It's a problem that assisted living doesn't include room and board. In assisted living, maybe we should pay more for the first 30 days of a stay like we do in a nursing home. And in assisted living, because of the what some of the providers told us is that because of the rate reductions that have been made for the EW program, which is how the state pays for assisted living, that they are needing to limit the number of people with MA that they are willing to admit, newly admit, to their assisted living programs. So potentially the rate issues are leading to access issues in assisted living, at least in some assisted living programs. The stakeholders then told us about another issue, and this came up at all three of our meetings also, and it had to do with mental health issues related to either mental health, chemical dependency, behavioral needs, often those issues overlaid with physical disabilities, and especially for people under 65. They have difficulty integrating that population into a assisted living or into a nursing home. In many parts of the state, they lack access to psychiatric services. They wondered if separate settings should be provided for that population. And then an interesting thing that was pointed out was that this particular population, a lot of these folks would like to have their own apartment. They choose not to live in adult foster care, but because they're under 65, CMS, you're going to love this one, says, no, you can't go into assisted living because it's really too institutional. So the last option that's available to them is the nursing home. And they go to the nursing home in the interest of avoiding an institutional setting. the next issue that came up frequently had to do with Alzheimer's disease, and there were a lot of ways that this was looked at. Gaps in some communities for care for people with Alzheimer's in assisted living. We know that many assisted livings have memory care units, but some don't. And if they're the only assisted living in a community, then that option is not really available for them. People with early stage Alzheimer's needing 24-hour supervision, but not necessarily the RN oversight and care for ADLs, activities of daily living. And then a number of caregiver-related issues, needs for caregivers who are new as a caregiver, for education and social services and peer supports. There's times where some sort of a special short-term support for a caregiver may extend their ability to continue to serve as a caregiver. And possibly help to form some sort of an informal support team that when they're having trouble can step in and kind of take over for a little while, give them a break, help out. Another common theme had to do with flexibility. The need for reimbursement to be more flexible so that a person could be in a nursing home, they could easily go to assisted living and the money would follow them and so forth. Need to match the individual's need with the financing. A desire for greater flexibility in the setting and the regulation. And then client issues around client choice. Other themes that came up, maybe not quite as often, had to do with technology, reducing regulatory burden in nursing homes. An issue that came up in a couple different ways had to do with rural nursing homes and both the rate disparities and the small size and issues around ability to access people or residents who need Medicare-type services. At our first meeting in Waseca, it was actually a little bit stunning to get the sense that there was a general sentiment that they would not like to have a new form of licensure, that this would just be more, kind of more regulatory complexity, potentially more regulatory burden, and that we should, whatever we're going to do to try to address these types of needs, should be coming out of the systems and the structures that we have through adapting them or simplifying them in some way. So what seemed particularly interesting was that we we managed the three stakeholder meetings in an identical fashion. I was the facilitator at all of them. I used a script for my questions and for my introductory remarks. I clarified things, but that was responding to what was raised by people that were there. The purpose of the meeting was stated in each meeting in the same way. And that was, okay, we're looking at how do we pilot this new licensure level, this new form of care. And I drew that picture. But quickly, each meeting moved toward the kind of issues that I described, describing that there are gaps in services in the community, that there are certain kinds of needs or issues that need to be addressed, concerns that they had that weren't really a new form of licensure, but were something else. So because of that, we concluded, agency staff that are working on writing the report, concluded to recommend that there not be a pilot project per se, but instead what we are choosing to do, and of course this is still a preliminary report, it's going to have to go through department approval and so forth, but what we're looking at is saying we think there are several strategies here that the legislature might want to address, might want to consider looking at in order to address some of the issues that did arise. The first one I'm calling boarding care. We have two forms of licensure in Minnesota. One is a nursing home, and one is called boarding care. Obviously, there's many other forms of licensure, like driving a car and so forth. But in terms of this context, if you're a boarding care, you are not able to be certified to participate in the Medicare program. And so one of the strategies that was suggested here said, why don't you let us transition pretty much whenever we think it makes sense for us as a nursing home, from nursing home to board and care, so that we don't have to be in Medicare. And we've evaluated that, and we think there's a seed of a potentially good idea in that, and that's that Minnesota has a law that says that any licensed nursing home that's in the Medicaid program must, this is Minnesota law now, this is not federal, okay, that facility must participate in the Medicare program unless Medicare won't allow them to. They have to do that. And I think that that was enacted many, many years ago with the purpose of saving the state money by assuring that anybody who's going to be eligible for Medicare stay, type stay, will get that stay paid for by Medicare, and therefore it won't be private pay or Medicaid, and therefore it saved the state money. We now are in a situation, we find ourselves, where nursing homes are competing heavily in order to get Medicare days. We don't necessarily need to require them to do something they really want to do. So one of the strategies that we're contemplating, and I think this may still need a little bit more research, is to suggest that you repeal that provision, the mandatory Medicare participation provision. Now, there's still that cost issue that I made reference to, but we think that we can address that by saying that if a facility has chosen to not be in the Medicare program, that when they are looking at admitting a person who is eligible for a Medicare stay, that they have to refer that person elsewhere. We have similar law in regard to home care on the books. Now, in the home care context, the law says that if you fail to make that referral, you're kicked out of the Medicaid program. That might be a little bit extreme. I don't think we want to go there, but I think there are other ways to address that issue. So that's one of the first strategies that we're recommending for consideration. The next one has to do with considering additional funding for various kinds of specialized services. And this could be, this is people whose needs show a high level of acuity. It could be certain diagnoses such as MS or ALS or Huntington's, brain injury, spinal cord injury. Could be people who need bariatric care, which was a very common theme, at least at one of the sites, where practically every nursing home that was represented in the room said two things. One, we do provide bariatric care. We have people that need this type of care. They're very hard to care for. It has all kinds of staffing and equipment, even building design implications. But the second thing they said was that they have to limit the number of people that they take of that sort. And their assertion was that these people are then backed up in the hospital, which is a lot more expensive than the nursing home. So we don't know if there's cost associated with increasing funding for some of these types of diagnoses or not. That's something that we will need to evaluate if there's an interest in moving forward with this type of approach. There was a lot of concerns that were expressed about assisted living, and so some of the strategies for you to consider, obviously, let's pay more for assisted living. Possibly also look at, it's easy for me to say, right? Let's look at rate enhancements for people in assisted living with specialized care. possibly also, because one of the issues that seemed to be coming up was that providers felt that when a person's condition was changing and they needed more care, that they couldn't get the county to come out and do a new assessment to correct that. And that this could be a training issue for the providers and possibly for the counties as well to assure that everybody has the same understanding of how to work with that system. And finally, we had a suggested strategy related to urban-rural issues. And in addition to the board and care one that I mentioned earlier, because I think that's primarily a rural issue, there may be some urban implication, but this one is to consider the creation of a model called which we would call a critical access nursing home. So you would take a facility that's geographically in an isolated area that has at least a certain elderly population base and designate them as such. It could be done on a competitive basis or not, and then provide some sort of an advantage to them to assure their fiscal health. And that, hard to imagine how you do that without some cost, too, Mr. Chair. In the area of Alzheimer's disease, we are preferring not to recommend any strategies at this time. And the reason for that is, as was noted by earlier testimony, you had the Alzheimer's Disease Working Group, and now the state has the PMA, Preparing Minnesota for Alzheimer's 2020 work group, that are doing extensive work on figuring out how to prepare the state for this, and we didn't see any reason or benefit in us adding any new strategies to that. They're pretty big processes that are underway for that. In regard to mental health, similarly, we've got a Medicaid waiver reform proposal that's going to look at some mental health issues, and also the Money Follows the Person, which will be looking at some mental health issues. And finally, the Money Follows the Person grant, which is a federal grant that Minnesota has, is looking at flexibility and use of funds, and so we didn't want to add any additional recommendations to the mix on that issue either.
Well, thanks. You think that, so you think we can use this, do this, address this need with existing facilities, or do you have to create a third kind of place?
Which need?
Well, you talked about this whole challenge of this hybrid, this group that's not served well in nursing homes, and they should go somewhere else. That's your whole point, I think. If it's assisted living or with some other accommodations, there's not a need for a third kind of place.
Mr. Chair, we didn't see the need, and we didn't hear any argument, compelling argument. That, I mean, there clearly are some people who feel that there is such a need. We felt that most of the people that talked to that issue at our meetings preferred not to go that direction.
Yeah. You plan to bring a... So you're waiting for our direction to go further than this?
I'm hoping to complete the report in 2 or 3 weeks. And at this point, I'm hoping that it will be essentially what I presented to you.
All right.
I'd be available to assist with, you know, technical assistance on any of the issues that you want us to look at.
Now, time-wise, 2 or 3 weeks, we're getting into the 3 weeks before deadline by then, or two, or the first deadline, and things move along. And so do you think that we should try to do something about this year yet? And get some people working on their own little projects and kind of circle some creative minds, and or is that impractical?
Mr. Chair, if there's issues that were raised that you or members are interested in moving forward with, I would be glad to work with them starting about 20 minutes.
Cool. Questions from members?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Held. One of the questions, could you just, you touched on it a little bit on the elderly waivers and some of the indirect consequences or direct consequences of that. Could you just elaborate on that a little bit more?
Mr. Held.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, the elderly waiver is the Medicaid program that is used to finance home and community-based services for people who are Medicaid eligible. It is used quite a bit to finance assisted living through what they call customized living. And that's why the report kind of got into the issues of EW and assisted living. If you'd like any further information about that, there is somebody sitting here who's quite expert on that
program. We're going to spend about 5 more minutes on this topic, so whatever we can fit into that time.
And Mr. Chairman, if other members would like to have other questions, I can follow up with that separately.
Representative Laughlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Held, I just wondered if you could just kind of summarize sort of the major stakeholders or participants in these meetings, because it sounded to me like the issues that you're bringing forward were the ones that I hear more from assisted living providers and nursing home administrators, as opposed to consumers or families who are on the other part of elderly waiver who are trying to help people through transitions. And so I'm just wondering if you could kind of give us a sense of who was bringing, you know, more of the feedback and participation in these meetings.
Mr. Held.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, the assisted living and nursing home affiliated individuals, often administrators, sometimes nursing directors, were the predominant attendees at the meetings, and they were roughly equally represented. We also had people at, I think, each of the meetings from county social services or public health. We had people at one or two of the meetings from health plans. We did have consumer advocates there, but very, very few. It was frankly a bit of a disappointment. We had an invitation. It will be in one of the appendices to the report, and we did everything we could to get it distributed as widely as possible. And I thought there would be more consumer representatives at the meeting than there were. Alzheimer's Association was at one meeting. Ombudsman representatives were at one or two.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, because I just feel like there's sort of a gap here in terms of the feedback in and some of the things I had hoped would get focused on that I hear about in terms of transition problems and people being discharged from assisted living fairly suddenly without transition plans because their needs get higher and some of those kind of issues that are more at the consumer perspective that I thought you would hear more about.
Maybe there's a lot there. Part of it is we should just, this is making me kind of think a little bit. So the people on elderly waiver leaving assisted living, we have more responsibility for than those people who are leaving on a cash basis and they're being discharged. And that might be something you want to just look into and see if we should require a transition plan for discharge on an elderly waiver person. Because that's kind of our job. The people, you know, there's less an argument on the other population where they're still self-directing or on their own time. Other question for you. Mr. Held, you want to react to that?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering if that's an issue related to private pay people in assisted living or more of an EW issue. It sounds to me like it would be an EW issue because with private pay they can say, well, you need more services, this is what's got to happen.
So maybe the, not to pile more on the assisted livings, but if they have a client in elderly waiver, they have a certain duty, you know, and the county should be engaging because they're our agents in this, right? That's just something to talk about offline. You're just making me think out loud. I have a question. You said there's an uptake issue with elderly waiver clients in some situations. Are those places with low elderly waiver populations or already high elderly waiver populations?
Mr. Chair, we did not. I didn't get enough of that from. I mean, you'd have to actually do a formal study to know that.
Yeah.
The person that brought up the issue had a fairly low EW, but maintained a policy of allowing people who came in as private pay to transition to EW and stay.
Yeah.
But and had always allowed people to be newly admitted who were on EW and had to stop doing that.
Yeah.
And felt that there were other providers that were doing the same thing.
Yeah, and so there's things I can say that generate phone calls. And one thing is that, you know, we have not set a minimum amount, like dentists have to take 20% MA clients to get, you know, that's part of their duty to be in a plan. And we've not set a minimum threshold or floor of what people have to take to function in Minnesota as an assisted living. And so that's always out there if they want to not help us out here. And right now it's voluntary, and I encourage them to keep on doing the right thing about that. But we have a need to serve people in this state, and we have money to do it. And so we're all in this together, I kind of think. So, other questions or comments? So I think that just as homework, there's something to this, I think, that you've stumbled on with Senator Rosen and all. And I don't know who's going to take it up, but if somebody wants to work on this, I'd be happy to, you know, whoever wants to, I mean, this is not a partisan matter. If somebody wants to dig in on this a little bit and see if we should follow up on elderly waiver people that have come and gone through a system and now they're kind of left in the lurch and the county's not picking up on that, we can find a way to help that to be more seamless and to help them get to where they're supposed to go. That's just a good policy thing, but and make sure we're paying the right amount and to accommodate that. So. Yeah, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to ask Mr. Held, you know, it's kind of relevant to this whole conversation. Assisted living generally, are we finding that there's enough, are there enough facilities to meet the need, or is this something, I mean, without regard to whether elderly waiver is playing or what, but I mean, are these, or are there lots of facilities that aren't filled, or what's the trend line there?
Mr. Held.
Mr. Chair, Representative, one of the things that was said in one of the meetings that nobody argued with, and this might have been more of a regional thing, was that the nursing homes and the assisted living are competing for clients. And it says to me that there's a little bit of excess capacity on both sides. We have felt for a long time that we're overbedded on nursing homes. We've actually closed a third of our nursing home beds in the state since we had our peak number. And yet, nursing homes have a relatively low occupancy statewide right now. It's about 90% is the number that we're hearing. We're also hearing that assisted living facilities have fairly low occupancy. We have done a wonderful job building an assisted living industry in Minnesota. It's now probably more than twice as big as the nursing home industry in terms of the capacity to serve people, the number of people that they could serve. So I mean, there certainly may be areas of the state where there's not enough of one or the other, and there may be specific services that would be provided in some areas but aren't provided in all areas, like memory care in assisted living. But I think overall we've actually got quite a bit, and my expert over here is nodding yes to me.
Representative Laffler, do you have a short question? We're going to move on.
Well, I'm just going to make a statement that I think we have, at least in the metro area, overbuilt assisted living. And the risk to us and the taxpayers in Minnesota is that then to when they have low capacity, unused capacity, that they market to seniors before that need is there, and they spend down their own private assets. And just about the time they do start to need a little extra care, is the time then they have to switch on to public pay. And, you know, if you're the operator of an assisted living that's at, you know, 40% capacity, the pressure's on you to fill those beds. And I think we do need to worry about that.
That was part of the impetus for that consultation that's become a little controversial. So, anyway, Mr. Held, thank you. Glad we've kind of sparked a little discussion here, a little controversy. So, thanks. And if there's some ideas about this, how to address this, I'm open from the audience and others. You're dismissed, please. Now, if Mr. Leitz wants to come up and is Representative Barrett in the room? Yeah, he's welcome to join us at the table. And this is the report of the non-emergency medical transportation, Representatives Barrett and McDonald, and who else is on that task force? Is anybody else? So the House is Barrett and McDonald, and is there any of you guys on that? Oh, was she?
Yes,
Norton. And so she would, we didn't think to invite her. So anyway, so welcome to the committee, and you have a report to give us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Scott Leitz. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Healthcare at the Department of Human Services. Here today to give you an update on the non-emergency medical transportation issue. This is a issue that the legislature directed us to pull a work group together on over the interim and bring back a report. I'll do a little bit of an overview of what the issue is, some findings from the legislative auditor's office, what the directive was, and then what some of the recommendations from the group that worked were. As we work through the mechanics of the computer, I'll just go ahead and let you know that Medicaid programs are required under federal law to cover non-emergency transportation so that enrollees who are in Medicaid are able to access services, that they're able to actually get to appointments that they have for medical services. What the states operate under requirement that they provide transportation to the nearest qualified provider to provide those services using the least expensive type of appropriate transportation. And CMS at the federal level has given states pretty broad discretion over how they administer this program. The program as it's currently framed in Minnesota is that we have sort of two types of transportation, access transportation and special transportation. What access transportation is...
Excuse me, Mr. Leitz, I'm going to embarrass one of my representative friends. Representative Norton, if you want to come sit at the table, we're, I invited Representative Barrett to come as well, so I'm glad you're here. So both you and Representative Barrett have the privilege of the committee, so thanks. Mr. Leitz.
Access transportation services are those that are essentially covers transport by things like bus, taxi cab, or other sort of common commercial carriers, or by private vehicle. And it's available to folks who are ambulatory, and they can make their way to bus stops and do other types of things. DHS did have a vendor coordinate those services in 11 metro counties. There was a law that was passed in 2009 that ended that practice. And really right now the coordination is done by the counties for access transportation. And those counties employ a variety of different types of structures. Some use a vendor, others administer it locally at the county level. And it just varies by county on how that's done and different ways around the state. Special transportation really relates to accommodations for persons who have medical conditions and this was things that would exclude things such as ambulance service. So it's basically available to people who are unable to use a common carrier because they might have a physical or mental disability that would not enable them to be transported on a bus or other types of services. DHS uses a contracted vendor to determine level of need for these individuals for special transportation and then how long they need that special transportation for. And then the enrollees or caregivers of the enrollees arrange for individual rides directly with those providers and then they bill directly to DHS for that. This is an issue that has, this issue of medical transportation, non-emergency medical transportation has been one that I think has been frustrating for a number of parties over time, and it really led up to a report that the Legislative Auditor's Office released last year. It was one of the topics that they covered in 2010, leading up to a 2011 report, and they had a number of key findings that really provided, I think, a nice roadmap for where we should go to help to try to make the system a little bit better under the transportation that we're talking about here. It found that the dual systems of ATS and STS, access and special transportation, were duplicative and they were confusing. There were some elements of STS that I think the auditor found were kind of being administered in too much of an ad hoc fashion and that the record keeping that was being done on this really wasn't the way it should be. It wasn't consistent and it wasn't as detailed as it should be. The way the criteria were being put in place might have been narrower than what the state law had, that there were barriers for some enrollees from a variety of forces for them getting services, and that the assessment forms really tended to focus more on physical rather than mental impairments because folks on MA have both types of impairments oftentimes, or one or the other, and we were really maybe too much of a focus on the physical. And that in some cases, eligibility was being determined for extremely short periods of time, like for a day in certain cases. And so the auditor came back with a nice, I think, a good set of findings that we were able to look at. And what happened during last session was that the legislature directed DHS to develop a proposal that consolidated those two systems that were found to be confusing by the auditor into a single administrative structure for our fee-for-service Medicaid program. Directed us to look at issues identified in the OLA report, and then importantly to establish an advisory committee to provide input and oversight to that process. Report that back to the legislature and then draft any necessary legislation that would kind of encompass what the findings were from that advisory committee's work. Specifically, the legislature asked us to propose a single administrative structure, look at standardizing things such as eligibility, scheduling, and other types of things that would include oversight mechanisms and performance measures. This is something that we didn't really have a lot of good information on. We didn't know how well this program actually was functioning. And also to start to report and collect data at a more granular level. One of the findings in the report was that we were collecting data, but it wasn't really at a fine enough level for us to be able to report anything out on. And then furthermore, there was just a number of things that were required under the law. I think that there was an interest in allowing for additional public input into the processes that we had for eligibility establishing a complaint system for enrollees, development of a payment for volunteer no-load miles. This is a challenge, particularly in rural areas of Minnesota, where people will volunteer. They'll be reimbursed mileage for the miles that they're carrying someone to an appointment, but they don't get paid for miles when nobody is in the car. And if they have to travel a distance to pick someone up, that isn't reimbursed for them. And then to maximize the use of public transportation in concordance with the federal guidelines, which will require us to use the least costly way of doing this. In accordance with the statute, we pulled together an advisory committee. It was a broad group of people. It was a fairly large group made up of consumer groups, of advocates for various persons, providers of services, people who coordinated transportation. There was representation from the Department of Transportation on this committee, from counties, because they do a lot of the administering of the ATS program, and then from both bodies of the legislature as well as both parties of the legislature. So it was a fairly large group. And if I could say, Mr. Chair, this group I think had a large task in front of it, and it also had some challenging history and of issues that had occurred in the past. And it was a group that really, in very, very good faith, came together, really tried to take their hats off of what they were doing and look at what the best public policies were for Minnesota. So I think this group was a really useful information gathering and policy guiding force for the department on this. So I just want to make sure I make the committee aware of the good work that was done by everyone involved with this. That group met six times in a really compressed schedule. If you ask them, I'm sure they would agree with that, from September through December of this past year. They made recommendations back for action. And one of the things that a key recommendation that we'll get to, but one of the things I think that the committee discovered is that the issues here were complex and that they were complicated. And so we could make movement on some things, but that the work probably needed to continue, that there was still a number of issues that needed to be addressed moving forward for us to really make the system better than it function better than it has been. So I'll switch now to the actual recommendations. The first recommendation that the group had was that given that there was additional work that needed to occur, and I think everyone around the table did agree that that was something that was necessary, there was also an appetite to ensure that there was a permanent feedback mechanism to the department on this. I think one of the things that has occurred over time is that the department, for a variety of reasons I'm certain, did not have a very good public input mechanism into the processes that we had, and I think it led to a feeling like there was things happening that people didn't have input into. And so there was a desire by the group and a recommendation to create a permanent ongoing advisory committee with pretty broad representation similar to what was on the advisory committee that came out of the 2011 statute that would advise the department on policy matters, be involved in developing and updating a policy manual, and continue the work to more fully examine issues that people thought that were necessary. And I would say one of the things that's very important here is that this was really an opportunity, both through this group and moving forward, for us to continue to build consensus around the table among the various stakeholders around the right way to go, so that everyone feels they have an input into the process and are able to help guide us as best we can from a public policy overview. A recommendation consistent with what the legislation asked for to eliminate the separate ATS and STS designations. The committee found the distinction was confusing, not very useful, but that there should be flexibility in how services are delivered to enrollees whose needs and resources fall on a continuum. We've kind of boxed people into either an ATS or an STS when in actuality people's needs are across the continuum, and based on where they're at in the continuum, the types of transportation that's necessary for them to meet their services can vary as well. And so there was an interest in that, but that we do all of that under maintaining a really strong regulatory structure so that we're not introducing any concerns that people who are vulnerable may not get proper services and so forth. The action that they recommended was 2012 legislation eliminating that distinction, and that the 2013 legislature, based on the work that's going to occur in this committee, may wish to address the policies themselves. Second recommendation really related to establishing an assessment process that meets enrollees' needs. I think the key point here was that, again, similar to what was said earlier, matching enrollees' needs and resources to the most appropriate, least restrictive form of transportation was a goal here, that we should really be trying to match those up as much as possible. And I think folks came up to the table some really excellent ideas to do that. We simply didn't have the time to fully get through all of the processes on that. A key element that was raised was making sure that mental health was addressed in this determination, as well as physical health, and that we standardize and align with existing processes around disability determination. Some members raised that Metro Mobility, for example, had a good assessment process that could potentially be used as part of this, and so we need not rebuild existing systems. And then where an enrollee's condition is unlikely to change, that we don't need to reassess that. That once that's determined, that can simply allow for more extended periods of eligibility. I think the council recommended that they continue to meet to really flesh out these recommendations and propose legislation for the 2013 session. The third one is to establish an effective complaint process. There's no single way right now that we're able to easily track complaints and whether those complaints were resolved. And that's true of both complaints that providers have maybe with the department or with vendors that are being used, or that individuals have with the providers themselves. The committee was clear that we should have a feedback mechanism so that if there are complaints, folks know about them and what the resolution was, so that providers can continue to improve their work, and that we build a more effective communication policy out to folks around complaints and around policy changes that might be occurring. Again, this is work that the council was interested in continuing over the interim, developing more towards the 2013 session. There was a strong view that we should be maximizing the use of public transit, encouraging enrollees to use the least expensive form of public transportation. We had a presentation in one of the hearings about Washington State, where they provide a monthly bus pass to individuals rather than individual bus tokens. They can use that bus pass to get to their medical appointments, but then they can also use it to go to other things that they're going on. And Washington found that to be a really administratively straightforward, cost-saving way to do their business. So I think there's a lot of interest in examining those sorts of things, as well as other successful strategies. The DHS has taken this recommendation back. We've been working with the Minnesota Department of Transportation, the Met Council, and we're reviewing that that as part of a potential for a 2012 legislative action. There was an interest in getting in place some evaluation measures around how well we're doing with this program. We don't have a lot of those good measures right now. So a recommendation to adopt some key measures, to collect the data to do that, and then to make that data available to the public. The committee will continue to flesh that out. We do think this is one where we can move forward relatively rapidly in getting these put in place. And that probably is something we can do administratively within the agency. The committee did identify that we weren't able to solve all the problems. We were able to identify, I think, a pathway to get to a lot of them, but that there was some additional work that was really going to be necessary moving forward. And those really relate to the work that we're going to charge this new advisory committee, if it's formed and when it's formed, to look at. Developing a proposal for a single administrative structure, as is required under the law. What we will be proposing likely this year would be to eliminate the distinction between the two, but what actually needs to occur now is the work of what that actually looks like. Again, some good thoughts that are already out there, but they need some further fleshing. The work of this group would then also be looking at drafting legislative proposals for the 2013 session to finish up any work that we're not either able to do administratively within the agency or that the 2012 legislation doesn't address. And then to follow up on some specific issues that were identified by the council as needing more work. There's not a good policy manual in place on this program right now. The DHS believes we need to get one in place, and we actually need to work with this group to help flesh out what should be in that. I think one of the things that's occurred over time is that as policy decisions were made, they were made in a rather ad hoc manner sometimes, and we would prefer that to be a much more straightforward policy-based manual. To identify who should be responsible for various functions, and then this knotty issue that this committee wasn't able to solve but did continue to raise of developing policy and how we fund to pay for volunteers no load miles. This will be one that is important to get resolved. Again, folks coming with some ideas on that, but no resolution yet on that particular issue. With that, Mr. Chair, that's the overview.
Do the members of the committee want to Representative McDonald? You want to offer us?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would share Mr. Leitz's comments about the committee. They really worked very well. It was a lot of components coming together. There was a lot of ideas, a lot of strong passions, and they worked very well together. And I think they came up with, I think we came up with some great solutions. And I think all parties included are generally accepting of the recommendations. And I think you're right, Mr. Leitz. I think the advisory committee is something that is important and should continue on to further enhance this program. My comment is the one concern I have is to have a committee, advisory committee, that doesn't sunset it, that just meets for the sake of meeting. So I'm reluctant a little bit to put into law that it's a permanent advisory committee, although it has strong merit, but I think it's important that we at least renew it year by year to make sure that we're effective. Hopefully with this group, because we are, most of them are very smart individuals and come up with some great solutions, perhaps we don't need to have a permanent advisory committee. So that is one of my concerns. I see that board members would renew every 3 years their terms, so I would advise that we look at that each year and not have a permanent advisory committee. One recommendation. And then lastly, there are some great recommendations, although being rambunctious, we'd like to see some of those implemented a little bit sooner. The OLA's report was 2011, especially putting together the single administrative structure from two into one. So personally, some of us would like to see it implemented in 2013 and not 2014. But those are some of the things that we can discuss in the committee as well. I think it's something that we should be concerned about, having it yet 2 years away. So those are some of the comments that I have. And lastly, in using public transportation was a huge component of our discussions. And I think the advisory committee's findings to encourage the enrollees to use public transportation is strong and good because we have a great public transportation. But I think the language needs to be a little stronger. I think in our level of need assessment, and we talked about the criteria of the enrollees, I think we not only need to require encourage individuals, but require them when they are at the level of need, see fit that they can take public transportation. So I hope those are some of the comments that we can incorporate in legislation and consider in this committee.
Thanks. Representative Norton, do you want to offer any thoughts?
Well, just thank you for the report, and for this was a big group, and we met regularly with Second Family over the interim. So there's a lot of work that went in, a lot of great discussion, and frankly, as you've heard, a lot more work to do that we just couldn't get done in the short period of time that we had. So I think the committee is going to be necessary not only to get to the rest of the issues, but that this particular issue comes up, as many of you know, year after year after year up here at the Capitol. And I think the thought was, if we have an advisory committee that's there and standing, it can deal with these issues, and it doesn't have to get to the boiling point where it has in the past few years, where people are furious and we're back here year after year not solving problems. So that was kind of the hope, and you know, I think we need to have that discussion and hopefully move the committee forward in some form this year. I would say one thing that didn't come up, the issue of no-load miles, the issue of volunteers, all these were, the issue of using more public transportation were all very important parts of our conversation over those months. As Commissioner Leitz said, this particular, I think, language that you'll see in the changes are with fee-for-service, and there's a lot of managed care involved in this too, and we really didn't get into how we can impact that system as much as we probably could moving forward. So, I think we talked about including them in a committee hearing and fleshing that part out too, because we can't just deal with one sliver of the transportation. We have to look bigger at some point, and I'm hoping the committee, as we move ahead, can also do that.
Well, that's a good idea, because we're going more and more to, you know, the population in managed care is growing and the fee-for-service population is shrinking. And, you know, they can still opt out to stay in fee-for-service, but they estimate only half will do that. So it's, yeah, and I hope that as this goes forward, you can engage the health plans with their work. Because actually, we don't ever talk to them about this, it seems like. Representative Barrett, you want to offer a comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think a lot of what should be said has been said already, so I won't belabor the point, but I want to commend Mr. Leitz for the good work that he did and everyone within the department. It's like herding cats. A lot of people have different views on this issue, and a lot of people come from different perspectives, and a lot of folks have it sitting their bottom line and in addition to their ability to serve their clients. So they did a great job. We met six times, a lot of differing views, and we really actually accomplished a lot and really thought of things objectively. And so I thought that was a great process. I know there's some history on this. I don't know all the history. I don't want to know. But that was evident. So I look forward to working more about with this issue. I think, regarding the timing, Representative McDonald mentioned timing. I think timing is key here. Yeah, we had an OLA report that came out a year ago. We met, did some good work, going to do some more work. So we'd like to look at, and I've already talked to the department, we're going to look at what can be done this year so that we can make sure that we don't have these recommendations hang out for too long before they're implemented. I think we owe the people of Minnesota a quick and thoughtful and appropriate response as soon as we can possibly do it. So I thank everyone who was part of the committee. They did really good work.
Good. We do have a testifier. I almost forgot. Mr. Pinsky, are you here? Do you want to testify? And while they're coming, I want to remind three of you that you have three of you who are working on this. If you want to bring a bill forward, and I presume you're going to have a little bill, but it can be as big as you want. And Representative Norton mentioned family, and today is Representative Fritz's 48th anniversary, just in case you weren't on the floor to hear that. So we're kind of like family. Anyway, welcome to the committee, Mr. Pinsky. So congratulations to you, and here you are in Representative Fritz's 48th anniversary to testify at our committee.
That's fantastic.
Just kind of special.
Congratulations. Chairman Abler, committee members, good afternoon. My name is Mike Pinsky. I am the president of the Minnesota R80 Medical Transportation Coalition, and I would just, I guess, like to underscore what has already been said by the representatives at the table and also Commissioner Lights. As many of you may know, the Minnesota R80 Medical Transportation was one of the associations that pushed and lobbied for the audit that was conducted a couple of years ago. We stand by those results, are satisfied with those results. As a participant in the meeting process so far, the advisory council meetings. I'm very satisfied with the report that's before all of you today. I do acknowledge that there's more work that probably does need to be done. However, given the limited time schedule with last session's government shutdown, I do believe we did get off to somewhat of a late start. And I'm encouraged with Representative Barrett's comments about trying to get as much done as we can during this session. I would probably encourage DHS to adopt a more aggressive meeting schedule and timeline, but I feel that once this advisory council is formalized and finalized, that the council members themselves may choose to seek a sooner resolution rather than later. So thank you.
Well, good. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Lights. Do you intend to disband this advisory committee if it is not formalized through the legislative process, or is it your intention that no matter what, the value here is significant, that you would continue to work with this advisory council?
Mr. Light. Mr. Chair and Representative Kiffmeyer, it would be our hope that we would be able to get something in statute just so we have that formalization, that there's an adoption of it. The department is committed to having a much more input-based process, and I think would continue some form of a group that would be advisory to the commissioner beyond this regardless. But I think it would be our preference that we actually do get something in place so that we're able to formalize membership, make sure all the right voices are around the table. But I do think that we found the process to be very valuable, and so we will be, if something isn't able to pass for whatever reason, I think it would still be our expectation we would seek forums for that same level of input.
Thank you, Mr. Lights.
Representative Love.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Lights. I think you've got a lot of stuff on the plate already, but one of the things I would hope you'd look into is whether or not we can maximize federal reimbursement in the administrative costs here. And I think that when responsibilities were shifted back to the counties, that a fair amount of property taxes ended up having to get diverted into running and administering these programs, and that we really should try and get federal reimbursement under MA for that. And the second thing is, just because I didn't hear anyone on your committee representing the city bus users like I and Representative Murphy do, I would just say that I don't see enough language here that really deals with the realities of people taking city bus services in the city of Minneapolis. And I don't know, and I assume it's the same in St. Paul. When I take the bus, I occasionally take it with a woman who uses a walker. And like most people with disabilities and age, they try to maximize their independence as much as they can. And she hobbles along the 5 weeks blocks from her house to that bus stop, and is glad to do it on the good days. But when you think of a winter like last year, when we had those mountains of snow, it would be impossible for her to be expected to take that walker across those kinds of streets to get to the thing. And it says here that there should be an appeals process if people's circumstances change, but that's not really very effective. And so I think we do need some real-world sort of thinking through of what it means to ask people to take those bus services, particularly when they oftentimes have to transfer two or three times to get to a specialist's office. Oftentimes those are in the suburbs, and for people in the city that means, you know, several different transfers along the way. So it's not as seamless as it might appear, or as easy for those of us who are fully able-bodied.
Other comments? And yeah, we spent our time. But perhaps in the past, I know, Mr. Lights, as you staff these projects, there was actually middle-level staff that actually worked on some of this. And so if this is going to be an ongoing thing, I know some of you who are working on this, and some of you are pretty engaged in other things as well. So don't be shy to spread the load there, you know. did I say it nice enough?
I'll take that back in your chair.
Because that way, because this is our... I don't remember how many years I've been sitting through discussions about this, but it's been a long time. I remember Duke Powell was here and that whole thing. And it's how many years?
A number, Mr. Chair, and it's our goal that to make it such that you don't have to hear about
that. That'd be nice. So there'll be a hearing coming up with whatever proposal you guys conjure up. Thank you for your time. And and we're meeting tomorrow, right? So 12:30. See you then. We're adjourned.